It's like the space industry builds one of the most advanced technologies in the world, but uses every other marketing tool that is from the previous century.
You're now listening to Space Forward Podcast. I'm Hussein Bukhari, your host. With me are Matthias Frenzel and Benjamin Shapiro. In this episode, we talk about the rise of first space marketplaces and how SatSearch's product Knowledge Graph helps solving problems for marketplace users. We ask, what kind of acquisition loops work in the space sector? How does their experiment framework look like? And should space marketplaces scale vertically or horizontally? We talk about unit economics, defensibility, and how SatSearch bootstrapped their way forward with the support of ESA Business Incubation Center. Our guest today is Narayan Prasad, co-founder and COO of SatSearch, a global marketplace for space industry. Incubated by this European Space Agency, Narayan is a multiple academic degree holder in space-related sciences, a vivid member of the Indian space community, and Indian and Germany living space entrepreneur. Narayan, it's great to have you with us. You have a very interesting and unique biography, and I'm very curious to understand, you know, how all of this unfolded and who is Narayan Prasad Nagendra. So you're from India, you're living in Berlin, Germany, one bachelor, four master's degrees, space science, astrophysics, space law, and you just finished your PhD on a thesis on satellite big data. Co-founder of SatSearch, obviously, and it seems like you're an active member of the Indian space community. Cannot highlight your own podcast, New Space India, which is, so tell us a little bit about yourself. What drives you and keeps you up at night? What has made you do so much?
Look, I think my story goes back to like very simple days as such, because most people in the space sector are inspired by their childhood about stars and space and everything of that nature. And I was actually lucky that I stumbled into the space sector through friends of mine who said, let's do a project that's related to, you know, building aerospace, like UAVs, for example. And then we did a project on microsatellites, you know, building structures around. So I was actually lucky because without my friends putting together that project, I would have never uncovered space as a sector and would have never discovered space as something that I really love doing, right? So because I had no such childhood dreams about stars or whatever, astronauts or so on. Growing up in southern part of India, coming from a pretty like, you know, usual Indian family as any of them. And even my parents are not really scientists or any big, you know, science enthusiasts as such. You know, they it just pushed us to do whatever we can. So I was very lucky to encounter that and did some of these projects and then realized that this is like the world that I love, you know, working in the space sector, and got on with my life to coming here to Europe and studied in all of these different places, went back to India, started a company there, ran the company for 5 years. It was really messed up, the experiences of having to do entrepreneurship in a place like India, where it was still very early days of new space, where, you know, essentially all of the contracts are attached to the space agency. And essentially you have to rely on getting contracts there. And only now in the last like 4 or 5 years, the things have been opening up in India as such. And so my frustration again led me back to coming back to Europe. And the way that I could come back is to like subsidize myself coming back was through the PhD route. So actually, you know, getting a PhD allowed me to like come back to Europe, take the time of building up a company like SatSearch at the same time, and at the same time not worrying about, you know, staying alive. Actually doing two jobs at a time, like working on my PhD, running SatSearch at the same time. And we were kind of lucky because the first time I met Karthik was 10 years ago at an event in Bangalore that I was running. And we had just this good timing and a good relationship that we kept up. And then everything fell into place. And again, you know, with all the luck behind us, by the time I was finishing my PhD, you know, my colleagues were also looking at doing the SAT search full time, we had enough customer traction in the market to be able to do this full time as well. So it really gave us a path towards being sustainable. We are, you know, more or less a very traditional space company as such. We don't have any large venture capitalists or any of that nature behind us. So we're purely a customer driven company as such. So, you know, we're really tied to our customers and the market itself. So tomorrow, if our customers perish or we don't drive enough value to our customers, you know, we get off the market as well. So that's given us a lot of the footholding in terms of how we can build our company and how we can scale. But, you know, coming from a place like India, I always used to ask some of my colleagues here in Europe, like, tell me one supplier you know in India who can do some space stuff, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, we've created an ecosystem around in different parts of the world where suppliers and the capabilities and suppliers are funded through taxpayers. And it works like islands. Like the US is one massive island where taxpayers keep funding cycles of suppliers and suppliers keep producing stuff that the US government needs through NASA or DOD, wherever. It's the same in Europe, where you have ESA and, you know, all these national space agencies funding. And then the money, it obviously makes sense because nobody wants taxpayers to fund other countries, right? So it does make sense that, you know, those capabilities are built there. But then we've never experienced a moment where commercialization of space will lead to globalization of supply chains, right? Because it's the theory behind every other industry in the world, which is driven by technology, where if you see any mature technology landscapes in the world in any other industry, right, the one thing that you will see that is automatic is globalization of supply chains. And it's happened across everything, right? So it's taken, you take the example of something like the aviation world, where it was all military, you know, doing very much taxpayers funding militaries to build aircrafts, and then, you know, keeping a very tight hold on the IP and the production and the supplier landscape. Suddenly the commercial aviation world takes off. And today, you know, like a small, you know, vendor up in southern India is producing some nuts and bolts and, you know, whatever, composite panels to an aircraft that is carrying people in Europe, for example, and nobody knows, right? And procurement happens in the orders of what is the price per kilogram and not what is the technology. That's how mature aviation supply chains have become at the end. And so this is something that we've not seen in space. And for us, you know, we at SatSearch believe that there are about 100,000 suppliers that are relevant to the space industry. And unfortunately, you know, all of us, including us at SatSearch, don't know these 100,000 suppliers and cannot map them today. But we've done mapping of about 3,000 suppliers as of today, and we've identified their capabilities and what they're able to produce and, you know, how good they are in many of these things. And for us, you know, the goal is to capture these 100,000 suppliers that we believe are very important for commercialization of space, and to then, you know, globalize the supply chain. And eventually that is the way that we believe is the path to reducing the access to cost to get to space, and also the cost of, you know, doing space missions, because not every person in the world will have the ability to take an approach like what SpaceX does or OneWeb does or whoever it is, where you vertically integrate everything in-house. I mean, it's like asking a company like Volkswagen saying, you produce everything in the automotive world and you vertically integrate into your car, right? It can work to a certain extent, to a certain volume, but you know, no company in the automotive industry will say we'll vertically integrate.
You know, you mentioned that you and Kartik got along very well. So did you guys bootstrap your way through and finance this entire thing yourself through the cash flow?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things with SatSearch is all of us co-founders are either, you know, space engineers, or in Alberto's case, he is from the world of bioinformatics and has done a PhD in that and has no relationship to the space industry. He's a straight on programmer. And so for us, you know, the idea of building the platform came with the of the intent, but also we had to learn other skill sets, like, you know, how do you actually sell to customers? What is the problem that we are solving? You know, what is it worth to this, to our customers? What can they pay us? You know, how can we scale up the platform? All of these are challenges that we had to actually solve in the process. And we had to also find our own roles within the company and, you know, look at who's going to handle relationships, who's going to handle sales, who's going to handle operations, all of these things, right? And I still believe that, you know, since we built software and, you know, we don't really need to buy a lot of components and hardware and everything else, we could bootstrap, because not every company in the space industry can do that, right? Because if you have to fly a satellite to prove a certain piece of technology, unless, you know, your parents and your family is rich enough, you cannot go build that by yourself. And the good thing is with SatSearch, since we built only software tools, we could build a version of the platform and go to a potential customer and ask them, you know, what's it worth for you if you get business through SatSearch, or you want to get access to the community that we are building. And, you know, we systematically ramped up that. We went to a few initial customers, turned them into early customers, early adopters, proved the value to them, scaled up prices to them, got into new customers. So today we have customers from 22 different countries. So that's been our approach. You know, it's like any other traditional IT SaaS software tool that's built. But we've, you know, applied our learnings from that world to this world. And, you know, that's how we've built the company up. And today, yeah, I mean, the other part of all of this is also, of course, you know, we are a small team that is doing, you know, what we can with the existing customers as such. And we still debate in the company as to, you know, should we go ahead and raise whatever large investment round or so on to build up the platform to what it is possible and the ideas that we have to scale and everything. And it's an ongoing debate that we have as well, because I also strongly believe that, you know, your customers keep you grounded because you're not burning money from someone else. But at the same time, you are really, you know, grounded to the customers and, you know, their problems. And until and unless we have a full visibility of their problems and the scale at which we can solve them, it may be a bad idea for any like company to raise a round of funding just to burn on hiring more people or so on. So, I mean, I may be wrong. There may be other approaches in all of this. But, you know, this is what works for us. And this is what we've been doing, at least.
Well, at least it's working for you guys. So are you currently using, like, internet website scraping tools to found 100,000 suppliers? Or are you? Do you have a product knowledge graph that you're working on internally?
Yeah, it's a mix of both. We have, you know, basically a lot of buyers, right, on our site. We have over 10,000 monthly active users who are searching on the site, looking for components, products, services, suppliers. And so, you know, the idea of, you know, what direction that we want to go is also driven by our own users in that sense, because at the end of the day, a lot of our users come to us because they trust our knowledge, the platform's ability to deliver to them. And, you know, the idea of growing the database also comes from just knowing what buyers really want to buy, because at the end of the day, that gives us a signal that if one person is searching for something, there may be someone else searching for the same thing. And if we are able to populate the database in that direction, it gives us an ability to go there and say, okay, this is what we can do, because, you know, we are, again, limited by resources, right? So we cannot simply close our eyes and say, okay, let's go populate everything we can at the end of the day. And, you know, it's also an interesting question, because people are not used to this kind of way of doing marketing and sales and business development in the industry. Because, you know, for example, we've had companies who have even threatened us legally to just listing their products on our site as well. So it really depends on, you know, how comfortable a particular supplier is. We've had suppliers who have been very enthusiastic about even sharing their data, sharing every piece of information, including prices, CAD models, you know, ICDs and things like that. But we've also had suppliers who've sent us legal notices saying, you know, why did you put my data on your site? You know, how come you guys didn't take permission from us and everything? And so it's a mixed bag in overall. You know, we've seen almost everything, every sort of behavior from suppliers out there. But, you know, as you build up credibility and as you build up the ability to showcase value to suppliers, I think a lot of those doubts go away. And then, you know, when we prove to people that there is value that we are creating and we can showcase that, I think that's the proof. Because at the end of the day, today, for us, you know, we are proving to suppliers on a daily basis that we're trying to generate business for them. We're trying to generate value for them. But at the same time, we are solving the problems that buyers have, right? So because on an average, an engineer spends between 2 and 3 weeks to get the sort of information the engineer wants to make a decision. And that's not attached to any technical data as such. It's just the back and forth that engineers have in, you know, getting whatever technical information or pricing information that they have. And, you know, how many industries are there in the world where people spend so much time in just back and forth between, you know, a person looking for some information and a supplier? And streamlining that itself is a massive, big opportunity that we see, for example.
What exactly, I'm trying to get a better understanding for this, and obviously our listeners will be too. You know, it's a B2B marketplace, right? That's the fundamental basis. What was the underlying thesis that you wanted to prove as you guys started this? And like, what was the problem that you're trying to solve here? Is it connecting? Is it finding? Is it both? Is it revenue opportunities? What is that?
Right. So there are two sides to the marketplace, right? So you have the buyer side of the marketplace and you have the supplier side of the marketplace, right? And on the buyer side, it's quite simple because we ourselves are space engineers and we knew what the problems were. It's very easy to figure that out. And for us on the buyer side, it was very simple. If new space economy is bringing a new supply chain in its own, right? So if you go talk to people at Thales or Airbus or, you know, ESA or wherever, their supply chain is built around the legacy space industry where they know the capabilities of suppliers, they know certain, you know, standards that they want to stick to, and they know their supply chains are built up very well for those kinds of missions that they do, right? But then if you are looking at the new space landscape where there are new entrants into the space industry, they don't really have the heritage of working at a company like Thales or Airbus or wherever it is. And they have led, you know, through some CubeSat projects or, you know, microsatellite projects or even, you know, non-space people coming into the space industry. They have no clue of how supply chains work as such, right? And so, and they don't really have these constraints of, I want to buy only from European vendors. I only want to buy from like American vendors or whatever it is. They may have some constraints of saying, okay, I don't want to buy from a vendor in Iran or, you know, vendor in North Korea or, you know, China or somewhere like that. That may be the, you know, very little restrictions that they have, unlike space agencies do or others do in that sense. And for them, you know, they have to undergo this discovery process of trying to understand, you know, they know what they want in terms of specifications. They do, they may not know who they want to get it from or what is the best price to performance they want to get for that and so on, right? So we are in the business of, you know, addressing that kind of a problem for buyers out there. And it's also about the transparency in what information that there is available in the marketplace. Because if you look at what suppliers provide historically, people will not even provide data sheets for components today, right? So even just getting data sheets at a component level is a massive struggle to a large extent. And one of the problems that we see is the marketplace can solve is if an engineer wants to get data, if it is only a data sheet or a CAD model or whatever it is, and if it's some sort of a proposal or a trade study or whatever it is that they're conducting, they should be able to get it without, you know, doing a massive amount of paperwork. And so even there, you know, supplier behaviors are changing in today. But then, you know, the process that an engineer has to go through to get all the technical and pricing information and the supply chain information, including like things like lead time or so on, the whole, you know, that the amount of man hours that engineers spend on all of that is really, really large compared to, you know, what the established supply chains in you know traditional space agencies or others would be, right? So, and also the procurement mechanisms are very different. So in a space agency, they may call for a tender where you just answer to the tender and then you know if you're the lowest bidder and you get the order, right? But in here, there's a lot of discovery. There's a lot of kind of trust building between the supplier and the buyer and everything else. So for that, for us, you know, the idea is that we want to be able to, you know, help these engineers work with them and then connect and then suppliers to basically use our platform to message all this information and make it open, right? So for us, if all of this information is available openly through our platform, for example, and it solves the problems of engineers and they're able to make quicker decisions and they're happy, that solves a massive problem for engineering teams and engineers at the end, right? And so the same for the buyer side and so on the supplier side, it's a different journey. And this is something that we had to discover ourselves is what is the problem that we are solving on the supplier side? And this had to be our own discovery because this is where our business model was also attached towards and so on. So, and then, you know, we looked at what the problem that we were solving. And the one thing that we noticed is that essentially every time we're bringing a buyer in front of the supplier, we're creating a business opportunity for them to sell to somebody new. Right. So, and, you know, for example, if a supplier up in Greece, you know, who has like 10 people working with them and they're specialized in some battery technology and, you know, don't really have a massive marketing workforce, a massive sales workforce, but they're really good at what they do, is able to, you know, say that I have the capability and the heritage and I have the, you know, wherewithal to kind of produce what a particular buyer wants. And is able to supply to a requirement up in, you know, Argentina, for example, the transaction between that person in between Argentina and Greece is very interesting, right? Because without the Argentinian buyer knowing that this Greek small company has this capability and is able to provide that at a price to performance that is the best in the world, the guy in Argentina, for example, may have to, you know, basically resort to some Google searches and finding maybe two or three people that he gets through Google, for example, and just gets to pick from them. But right. So, but then, you know, the value to this Greek supplier then becomes that us as a platform is able to give them this long tail value, because today space is being done in 60 plus countries that are out there, unlike, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And so this Greek SME is now, you know, getting value from us by getting to bid on an opportunity and even securing, for example, a contract from this Argentinian buyer. And, you know, that changes the nature of transactions in the space industry. And, you know, it really then opens up the landscape of opportunities for suppliers as well. So today, you know, about 50% of our users come from this long tail where they're all from these non-European, non-American geography and from all different parts of the world. We have South Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, India, you know, many, many places where we have users from, and they're building some very interesting projects and we get to learn from them as to what they want and so on. But then what is the cost of, you know, reaching out to these markets to a small company that is 10 or 15 people, you know, produces some specialized component up in Europe, for example? And, you know, that's the problem that we can resolve for a lot of them, right? Because we're actually putting these suppliers and their capabilities in front of these guys, these buyers to consider. And that may never have had happened because these suppliers, their focus is on, you know, their capacity, their capability, their technology. It's not on marketing, sales, or, you know, using SEO or whatever it is in terms of, you know, crafting how do you do digital marketing, for example, for their products. And so that's like a massive problem that we solve for all of these suppliers as such. And so the trust that we create on the buyer side and the work that we do with the suppliers is the combination of how the platform works at the end.
gears a question. I mean, it seems like a lot of the thing that you're doing is consistently iterating. Companies usually run an experimental framework, which kind of allows them to have many experiments, you know, consistently going in a parallel fashion, especially software-based companies like yourselves. So I'm curious to get an idea around, you know, the cost and time for iterating and running experiments that you're suffering through right now. How many experiments are you running? Are you using like different approaches, like, for example, the Google Sprint design and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. We run, bi-weekly sprints. So our all the experiments that we run and how we run the company is on this bi-weekly sprint basis. And my colleague Karthik is, you know, really good at setting all of these up, and he's the one who's driving a lot of the product as such. And so it's also the mix of talent we have within the company itself that is very interesting, because, I haven't really had any experience of coding, or, you know, I can't even say what is the difference between two different kinds of loops, for example, if somebody asked me to do that. So I can't really tell, you know, what feature needs what kind of timeline to build, or, you know, what should we build, or so on. But at the same time, you know, Karthik really knows that, and Alberto can really build that as such. So we have a really good setup as such in the co-founding, you know, between the three co-founders, right? And so then we've had our colleague Hywel join us, you know, specializing in SEO and marketing and so on. So that gives us like a foundation within the small team to kind of build up all of these things. And so we actually look at focusing on buyers and what buyers want as features, and then looking at how long does that take and how does it add value to the suppliers at the same time. So, of course, you know, buyers may ask us to build something that they want that will take us 2 years to build with the workforce that we have, right? But it may not be reasonable for us to do it at the same time. But every feature that we build is directly related to either scaling up our community of users or related to monetization, and ideally both.
So you've got a wish list, and then you've got a more realistic list that you're carrying forward as you go.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a wish list that we can build for the next 10 years.
That's good. That's awesome. It's a marketplace. It's a chicken and egg problem. You have to buy the seller side to get the products on the website, buyer side with the cost in order to make sure that nothing else comes in the middle and you continue thriving as a company. So what was your approach to getting the two-sided network effect going for SatSearch? Like the market landscape, where do you go find to look for the supply and demand and the challenge that you've had in terms of the one that's been hardest to obtain?
Yeah, that's, for every marketplace, that's a big problem as such. And, you know, I think you always start with the buyers and keeping buyers happy. And then, you know, when buyers are happy, they also refer other buyers, right? They also see that they got a great experience of working with us. And they're telling other people, you know, wow, that these guys at SatSearch have solved our problems and so on. So you then have a small word of mouth going for you as such. And today, you know, that multiplicates itself as such. But then for us, initially, it's also reaching out to people who we know are buying as well, because we have a reasonably good network in the space industry. And, you know, we can always go to those initial set of people who we know are procuring or working on interesting projects and just telling them, you know, how can we help? You know, if you're procuring XYZ, can we help do the trade study for you? Can we help, you know, sorting this out for you and so on? And so we had, you know, a group of like 50, 60 people who we knew, for example, who are building interesting projects in the beginning. And then we just went to them and asked them, okay, you know, what are you kind of procuring and how can we help and there? And so that gave us an initial group of people who we trusted us, who were, reasonable in terms of giving us some kind of things that they wanted to procure or identify suppliers for and so on. So, and then, you know, that really allowed us to kind of go populate the database in that direction and then find those suppliers, create traction with them and then tell them, okay, we have a pretty interesting buyer for you. that you may want to talk to see if there's synergies for you. And that also then populates the supply side, because we've identified suppliers that the buyer wants to talk to, and then we've populated that database in that direction and so on, right? And the proof is in the pudding for many of these suppliers, because if a supplier says, I've had a great experience going through this process of discovering this buyer from you, and even if that buyer has not really placed the end order to this supplier because of whatever XYZ reason, their lead time is too long, or they don't have heritage, or their cost is too long, or whatever, too much or so on. There may be a number of reasons there. But then, you know, the supplier then gets the experience of saying, look, this becomes a valuable, you know, lead generation and a marketing channel for us. And if we are able to get one of them, what if we get you 10 of them or 100 of them, right? So, and then, you know, the idea is very simple. So the initial set of customers who we worked with, you know, really trusted us in that sense, saying, we don't know if your platform is going to work, right? And so we need our initial set of suppliers, our customers, to have a leap of faith that they will take with us, that the investment that they are making may not work. But if it does work, you know, it gets them business. So, so that was the journey for us in discovering our initial set of customers who really trusted us with their money and time, saying that, you know, we are willing to experiment and we're willing to fail with you if you guys are going to fail. But, you know, we're very, very, very happy, and, you know, we created that value to those customers. And, you know, today, we charge our initial set of customers that we had, you know, 6 times, 7 times the price that we onboarded them initially.
Wow.
So the growth
is exponential at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, for us, you know, the idea is very simple. So we try to make the barrier to entry very low. And at the same time, we want to create an excellent customer experience for every supplier at the same time. And then, you know, we want to show the evidence to those suppliers, to our customers, and tell them the reason why you're going to be paying us more, or why you need to pay us more, is because here's the evidence that you're getting traction through our platform.
So here's a question for you. I'm trying to figure this out. And it's been in my head that typically, you know, as you're starting off, you have to focus on resources. So, you know, which markets, region, countries that did you guys really go and start with? You know, you mentioned in the beginning that, you know, you had this island framework, that, you know, the USA is an island and the taxpayers are funding the suppliers to continue this cyclical model. So where did you sort of start and begin this process?
Yeah, the good thing is, you know, between me and Karthik, we already had relationships with, you know, tens and hundreds of suppliers already that we knew, for example, right? So, you know, Karthik, he's been here in Europe for a long, long time. I've been in India for a long time. I know, you know, hundreds of suppliers in India as such. And I've also worked in the previous company that I co-founded with several international suppliers at the same time. And, you know, for us, it was to go to these initial set of friends in the industry that we knew are supplying something or the other, and try to tell them this is what we want to build, and this presenting them with some evidence that their buyers interested in what they do, and then getting them to like have a leap of faith with us as such, right? So our first customer was Hyperion, which is a Dutch company. We are also a Dutch company, so they took that leap of faith with us, saying that, you know, let's try this out, and so on. And, you know, today, there's even after, like, now I think it's been 2 years since we have had a contract with them. And also the making the barrier of entry very, very low, because when we started out the platform, we almost gave the choice to suppliers who are our customers, saying that you can quit the platform with a 30-day notice. Right, so you come in, you pay on a monthly basis, but you can also quit with a 30-day notice to us. So there is no like, you know, long-term engagement for them. It's the barrier of entry becomes quite low to them and so on. That's how we created a lot of traction among suppliers, because we made the barrier to entry so low for these people, saying, okay, you know what, it may be worth it because I'm going to be experimenting it for a short time. Yeah, and I can always pull the plug on these guys if they don't deliver to me, right? There's no long-term engagement of any sort with us. And that's something that allowed us to be on our toes every single day, because we knew like the time is ticking with every customer that we have, and we need to deliver as much value as we can to most of them as such. All our customers today are on yearly contracts. So we've been able to move, and you know, we don't really engage with anybody on a short-term basis today anymore. And so that's the proof that the platform is kind of maturing as such. You know, because we have today customers from all of these 20 plus different countries, we can go back to any of the new prospects saying, you know, we're a mature enough company and we know what we're trying to do. And unfortunately, we can't engage with any of them on a trial basis or a short-term basis.
Yeah, because you have that heritage that the others are seeking. B2B, the time to benefit and time to fill could take a while due to corporate internal purchase processes and policies. You know, procurement frameworks within each company are very, very different. And I'm imagining that it actually influenced your unit economics in terms of cash liquidity and, you know, the liquidity of marketplace itself. You know, how are you dealing with that at the moment? And how did you deal with that in the past? Like, what was the journey around that?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question, because, you know, that also is a place where I think people can make a lot of mistakes, because building a business model around marketplaces is very different depending on the industry, depending on, you know, the purchase cycles and everything, right? So for us, the idea of us just becoming a reseller or a distributor was not very enthusiastic, because we also lose the neutrality of the marketplace, right? Because if our incentive is to say, you know, this person is our customer and we have to push our customer's product to be able to monetize, we become a distributor or a reseller and not a neutral entity in the transaction anymore, right? And so the way that we have done it is not to look at ourselves as a reseller or a distributor. And we also, you know, if we tell the buyers that our incentive is commission, or the buyers figure out, you know, the stat search guys, you know, get a commission on the sale that we make, it creates mistrust among buyers using the platform, right? So for us, you know, we think of ourselves as, any other SaaS subscription model that suppliers would have, right? And then what they're getting really access to is our, you know, community of buyers today, right? So essentially, you know, we have crafted SatSearch as a platform where buyers come to identify suppliers, to look for, you know, things, products and services. And then what most of our customers today are getting access to is this community of buyers that we have crafted. And in many cases, we are also helping suppliers find product market fit for their own components, right? So today, you know, like 80% of our customers are SMEs who have certain product market fit and they have their own businesses running. But 20% of our customers may be, you know, small companies or startups or so on, who are, you know, trying to find product market fit. And by, you know, helping them access our community of buyers today, we're also helping them know if they need to make changes to their products, or if the market is moving in a certain direction that they are not ready to do or move into, or, you know, if their product really works and if there's traction for that product. So the marketplace is also helping those kinds of customers as well at the end, right? Because at the end of the day, you'll not find many places in the space industry that has, you know, over 10,000 monthly active users who are all from the space.
So here's a perfect question for you. You know, it's a risk that startups get addicted to buy traffic from large platforms, in this case, Google. you know, which makes the entire enterprise dependent on Google. Besides this, the traffic has some sort of an upper limit, and especially in the space industry, because you have a hard time doing those conversions, consistently moving that clock forward. So a rule of thumb is to have three kinds of not correlating acquisition loops. So I'm trying to figure out what are your acquisition loops at the moment?
So, I mean, for us, it's very simple as such, because since we are dependent on buyers to tell us what they want, you know, the buyers, for example, you know, today we had a buyer saying, I want a 10 ampere hour lithium ion battery. I want to procure it. And so we know, for example, 10 suppliers or 15 suppliers who are able to produce that battery, because, you know, we've either got other suppliers to refer us, or we've Googled it ourselves and then populated the database, or we've had, you know, previous transactions with us or whatever. And so for us, you know, it's very simple. When we go to suppliers, we can tell them, okay, you know, this is a buyer that is here that is interested in your product. And then, you know, we then tell the supplier, they're saying, okay, now look, here is a buyer that we've made an introduction to. Do you want to answer, you know, more of these queries and be in these transactions more and more? Then you have to be a member on our platform, because that's the only way that, you know, we can convert these as customers, because we've given them the evidence that their products has traction through our community as well, right? So, and also it's about, what are the tools and techniques that most suppliers have used in marketing and sales in the industry? It's like the space industry builds one of the most advanced technologies in the world, but uses every other marketing tool that is from the previous century.
Yeah.
Right? So at the end of the day, you know, like people will tell me like, oh, I'm going to like half a dozen conferences and I have booths in all of these half a dozen conferences, and you know, we love meeting all of these people there and everything. And then I tell them, okay, look, there's some interesting set of buyers in Taiwan or Vietnam. Which conferences are you going there to meet these people? Right? So, yes, I mean, of course, I am a big believer in conferences. We do go to conferences as well, because we want to meet people as well. But, you know, it's about doing X, Y, Z things that gives differentiated results, right? So, for you to like, you know, become popular in the market, right? So, right. So, and also people will tell me, for example, I want to spend on like Twitter or LinkedIn or Facebook traffic or, you know, Google Ads or whatever it is. Unfortunately, the space industry is a pretty small industry as such. And any of these tools above become extremely, extremely hard for anybody to target. Because, you know, LinkedIn, you might want to like sponsor LinkedIn to get some ads on LinkedIn or so on. But LinkedIn segments people according to this defense and space as a category, right? And it's not space, and it's not space and then small sat, right? So the segmentation of the audience among any of these, you know, generic social networking or, you know, generic search platforms are almost, you know, doesn't return any kind of yield as such. And even if you have people clicking through those promoted, you know, promotions or so on, they may not be relevant for you as an audience. I mean, it may be somebody who is from the defense industry or aerospace industry who just likes to know what is happening in the space industry or so on, right, at the end. So you may register from some clicks to all of it, but it may not be that, you know, that's your target audience at the end, right? So for us, it's also educating suppliers about, you know, what they can do with digital marketing that enables them to target people a little bit more through the community and so on. And so if I'm talking to a person who's been doing marketing in the industry for like 20 years, for me, it's also to tell them what is the power of communities a little bit. Because at the end of the day, you know, the reason why they are so interested in having conference booths is because it's not a conference for defense, space, automotive, everybody coming to the same conference, right? It's conference booths are so effective in the space industry because it's a gathering of space people who are coming there and are interested to know what is happening in the industry and are either suppliers or buyers themselves. And then, you know, the idea is that the conference organizers have created a community of them, and suppliers are buying into access to those through conference booths, and they're, you know, standing there presenting themselves. But then, you know, we do the same thing as such, but then everything's online, and the long tail of it is present in 100+ countries, and it's all passive, because, you know, they don't need to stand there like they would stand there for like 2 or 3 days. But then, you know, we have that platform alive 365 days, you know, 24 hours, right? And so that in itself is a huge education to people in the industry, because when you're used to doing something, it's very hard to break that cycle and say, I want to try something
new. So at this
new.
Point, would you say that word of mouth has become the primary portion of your funnel, that a lot of it's happening through buyers and sellers who are already on the platform, who've seen positive results through customer interaction and contract closures, that now they're able to maximize that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mix of everything. You know, it cannot just be like word of mouth. It's a mix of everything on the buyer side. We've seen, for example, one engineer from one organization discovering us and letting other engineers know. So those his colleagues, for example, or her colleagues filing requests. We've seen people moving from one organization to the other and then taking us to that organization and introducing us there. We've seen CEOs of our existing customers who are funded by similar VC funds or same VCs referring us to other companies who the VC has funded, and then, you know, recommending us as a platform that they can use for marketing and sales. So we've had all kinds of different you know, referrals come through that we've noticed both on the buyer and the supplier side. And so, and yeah, so this is, I think, a little bit of a sign of maturity of the platform itself. But you know, we're still capturing like less than 1% of the value as such, because, you know, when I look at our customer list today, we have, you know, 35 customers or so on as such. But, you know, our goal is to really get there to 100,000 of them, right? So so we really just barely scratching the surface.
So here's a question. It's been 3 years now, almost. 2018, you got support from the ESA BIC program. How was that experience? How do you think that ESA, rather than a private organization, lent itself to progress and the growth of the business? Did it give you guys a boost at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because this is also related to my previous query or the answer that I gave you about getting threatening letters from suppliers, because, you know, SatSearch as a project began in 2015 itself. And in fact, you know, we were up already 2.5 years before we even got into the ESA BIC. So the one thing that ESA gave us is its brand name, right? The attachment of the brand name to ESA and so on, and being under the ESA hood. So we could say that we are supported by the European Space Agency, and that creates some trust among suppliers as such, right? So, and it also gives us some leverage when it comes to such, threatening letters. And when it happens to you for the first time, you're always scary because you're scared because you're thinking, okay, you know, we have nothing and these guys are threatening us already. But then, you know, this gives you some sort of a moat possibly around the ESA brand name. And it's also about the network, right? So the companies that we met through ESA events, we're very happy to also participate in several events. And in fact, ESA also sponsored a booth for us at the IAC in Bremen as well. So we had all of those kind introductions, networking events, sponsorship to attend a few events. And of course, you know, ESA also provides this 50,000 euro subsidy to invest in technology development and so on.
That supported you guys and gave you the right boost in order to get the platform off the ground.
Yeah. And also, given that it's also equity free, so you don't really give out any equity to ESA or so on. I mean, it's not a lot of money, but it's better than having no money.
Always. So you know, I'm trying to differentiate now for our listeners the difference between a marketplace for data and insights versus a marketplace for subsystems and satellite products. You know, there are other marketplaces like Cloudio in Berlin and BCG, DV portfolio company up 42, which is small, but it's growing pretty fast. You know, how do you see the market of space related marketplaces developing over the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, a very interesting trend that you have marketplaces popping up in lots of different places within the space industry. And, you know, we date back to many of these, right? So Up42 is also very recent, you know, Space Watchers, whoever it is. They're all coming up at the same time. And it's a sign of maturity of the industry coming together, because at the end of the day, the existence of a marketplace means that there is some sort of a competition that is ongoing between players. And there is some sort of attraction that buyers have in trusting these marketplaces, and that buyers are facing some sort of a difficulty at the same time. And the marketplace is able to like bridge the connection on both the buyer side and the supplier side at the same time, right? So I strongly believe that there are, you know, significant value in some of these marketplaces and how they're, you know, going to be creating value in the industry. And it's a sign of every other mature industry in B2B segments. Like if you look at, you know, companies like Airframer or others in the aviation world, for example, they have tons of marketplaces in the aviation world. There are even, you know, aviation world specific segments of marketplaces like MRO, like just for maintenance, repair, and overall, right? So even have segments there in the aviation sector, right? You have it in the automotive sector, you have it in materials, you have it in almost every other industry that are out there. And, you know, why is it that we in the space industry don't have many of them and the other industries have? It's maybe because they're already mature industries and there's enough transactions going on through those marketplaces in those other industries that are there. And we're just, you know, building that up in the space industry only now, while some of these people have done that 10 or 15 or 20 years ago in other industries.
The other thing that I consistently keep thinking about when it comes to marketplace is the future of space commercialization and then how that's going to sort of play a large role into, you know, setting up these key hubs that marketplace will become. So how will the future of space commercialization and the entry of more private actors, which is a move towards space to space as opposed to space for Earth economy, change the supply demand dynamic for space goods and services in sat search type of marketplaces? How do you see and where do you see the ESAs of the world, the NASAs of the world, and the government and institutional actors participating at that point?
Right. I think there are two aspects to this, right? So I'm from Bangalore in India, and for example, the set of problems that the society in India faces that can be solved with space is very different from the one that Europe faces, right? And so it becomes interesting when space entrepreneurs in India come up with this idea of, we want to solve local problems that our society is facing, and we want to use space to do it, and they connect to that local cultural problem and are able to solve it at a price point that works there. And, you know, getting to know that problem and having to have the cultural background to know it and how to solve it, it's not like, you know, you build an aircraft in Europe and take it to India and fly the same thing there, because people want to fly, right? So obviously, there are all of these nuances that are coming in when it comes to societies in many other parts of the world. And we haven't even uncovered these problems in geographies like Africa or, you know, Southeast Asia or Latin America or wherever, right? And so for me, I think this is one of the most exciting things that are out there, because I think that all of these problems are in places where people have never thought about using space-based solutions. And today, you know, because of all of this convergence in cloud and, you know, cost based solutions and low cost to launch, and all of these things are converging in such a fashion that the solutions to all of these problems, you know, become viable in the near future, where even if they don't have space agencies that are able to do it, people are able to then raise enough capital to go solve that problem by themselves and capture value out of it, right? So, for me, I think space agencies should exist to fund technology development that is 25 years from now. It doesn't make any sense that a space agency should fund taxpayer money into a problem that industry can solve. So at the end of the day, you know, that is the restructuring that I think is interesting to see as such. So that was one part of it. The second is also about how do you incentivize, your suppliers to do more commercial business? Because one of the things that happened with legacy space agencies and legacy space is because the way space is organized and funded for the last 60 years, because of the circulation of taxpayer money into, you know, certain programs and capabilities being kept alive, it almost becomes, you know, having zero incentive to do any commercial business for many suppliers. Because you're just saying, okay, like, you know, I'm happy that I have 15 people or 20 people in my business, tendering to this local demand that I have from this X space agency. And I know that the demand is stable and I'm going to be getting these revenues for the next 20 years until I retire. This unit can go on by itself. And for them, you know, for most of these kinds of suppliers, they're just happy doing what they are on a routine basis. And the space agencies just keep them alive with all of their contracts. And there's no like market dynamics that give them any kind of push or pull in any case. Some of them may be ambitious in trying new things and trying out to reach out to the commercial markets, but there should be some sort of an incentive that pushes to them in that direction, right? So, and unfortunately, I think not many space agencies may be thinking in this direction already, but I think if commercial space is going to like take on a lot of these new opening up of new market segments and, you know, there's some kind of a redistribution of how commercial space is done and how research funding is done differently in the space sector altogether, then I think, you know, we'll also see, you know, space agencies crafting procurement or structuring, you know, their own performance in a way that they will push these kinds of vendors within their own network to do more commercial stuff.
That just means that indicators will be different at that point, that everybody will be not necessarily looking out for themselves, but looking out for the ecosystem, you know, at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it is as simple as this, right? So for example, if ESA says, I'm going to give you like 1 million euros to do this program for us, it's taxpayer money that you're funding. Today, I don't think so. I may be wrong, but I don't think so that anybody will come and ask you, tell me how much of this is translated to commercial business at the end of maybe, not now, maybe in 5 years.
Let's look at the Clean Space Initiative. Yeah. Let's talk about the space debris initiative that ESA launched with the company that's based out of Switzerland. It's a prime example of that, and I think it's important to feed that one of the things that government is trying to do, or at least in my head, the government is trying to do, is trying to be a lot more hands off. And do you think that they're going to be hands off for, you know, in the near future for and give the reins to folks like yourself? From a marketplace standpoint, be like, hey, you know, you have all of this map. Why don't you take this over? Why don't you become the middle ground?
The thing is, it's going to be a cultural change that is going to take a long time. Nothing can happen overnight for sure, because the set of incentives that are already in place for people to act on are already, you know, it takes a massive cultural change in all of this, right? Because I think it's a slow process. It's going to take at least, you know, like 10 years or more, in my opinion. And, you know, that's because people need to realize, and the push and pull will come from, you know, other places where they see other companies succeeding. And governments will realize that, you know, maybe in different markets, the spending that the government is doing becomes lower and lower, and the commercial segment is taking up. And then, you know, there's more and more commercial activity that's happening, and then at the end governments realize that there is a difference between how much taxpayers are funding something and how much the government is earning at the end as tax revenues. Because at the end of the day, every government wants, no matter what field of technology it is funding, tax revenues. That's the incentive for any government out there. And of course, in space, you know, there may be sovereignty and, you know, access to technology and all of these things that also come into place, which are very important for most governments. But once commercial activity kicks off and one region of the world and one set of suppliers or actors are able to show that commercial markets have taken over certain supply chains and certain parts of the industry, and they're able to file, you know, taxes by generating revenue and servicing customers in that segment, obviously, you know, governments in a reasonable country anywhere will be asking the same question as to why we're not able to do that. And that's, I think, is the path towards the systematic approach to looking at how can we mature some segments. Because at the end of the day, you know, we have massive amount of different segments where the level of commercialization in each one of them is very different, right? So nobody believes that space agencies need to build satellite DTH television satellites anymore. That was a problem that solved like 50 years ago, maybe, right? And it's like foolish to ask a space agency to say, go build these, you know, DTH satellites. But there are, you know, space agencies building it at the moment. Like, you know, in India, we still build DTH satellites at the space agency. We've not seen suppliers take that over. And, you know, that's a massive opportunity there itself. And today, you know, you're seeing all of this LEO broadband, and, you know, that's another supply chain. You've seen like commercial Earth observation coming up and so on, right? So, and then, you know, you have all the other things, like you said, about space debris or space situational awareness or many, many other market segments that are in different levels of commercial maturity at the end. It may not be that everybody is going to be creating all of these revenues at the same time, and it may take one ecosystem or one part of the segment to be more mature at one point of time, and some may take more time at the end, but then that's how the industry works in any case.
Typically, we've seen that margins are improved in variety of manner. Marketplaces, they become vertically integrated, and some go the horizontal route. What is your strategy at SatSearch?
Yeah, again, it's an interesting question. And we ourselves have been thinking about this for a long, long time as to how do we actually make this bigger and better in a way that it works for everyone. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we can take different directions in, right? Of course, you know, today we can increase our subscription with the members that we have, and we can keep doing that as long as we reach that limit of 100,000 suppliers that we imagine of, and we can keep doing it. But then it's also interesting that we want to build out other tools that are interesting. So today, for example, the technology that we've built is underlying principles of them come to this field of model-based systems engineering, which, you know, my colleague Karthik is very adept to. So, for example, we're also looking at how can we actually almost build out this kind of Siri for space kind of a model, where if a certain engineer says, I want to know what is the power on a battery by Airbus at this point of time, there's no way that the engineer can know this without Googling for that information or getting it by email, downloading the data sheet, opening it up, figuring it out for it themselves, right? So today, the way we have built the marketplace, we can kind of do that. We can tell somebody, you know, query that exact specification and tell somebody, you know, that this is the value for this, right? So a lot of the standardization of how data is represented in technical information and, you know, how that can be pulled up and so on. So, and we also have an API, the SatSearch API, and that's being used by different tools in the industry today. And our biggest integrator today is NASA. So we have integrated ourselves into this small satellite virtual institute's, search engine that they've built. And so today, you know, anybody using that database to search for components or suppliers, they can find it through our API. And we've had, you know, few integrations with Valley Space and so on. So there's that integration of our library and creating the gold standard for products in electronic databases, right? And so, If an engineer, for example, who's designing a satellite wants a CAD model to be integrated into their, you know, CATIA model, today the process is they have to go find it, download it, and then put it in their database. So we can already use the SatSearch database to integrate that into CATIA, and the engineer doesn't need to go anywhere. They can just query our database and then drag and drop into their design environment, right?
So that means that you already have, so do you have a product graph which one can approach?
Yeah, absolutely. We can already serve CAD models. We can serve a lot of the information that engineers would need in the different life cycle of projects, or different simulation tools, different project tools, mission design tools, and so on. So, you know, we are integrating them in many of the industry tools, and we see ourselves as more of an ecosystem creator for these, for this data, because at the end of the day, you know, that is also value that we are creating both on the buyer side and the supplier side, because buyers don't need to download the data or, you know, manually enter any of this data anymore. They can simply query that through our engine. And at the same time, the footprint for the suppliers for their products and services becomes much, much bigger with our API. And so they're not just living on our site, they're living through our site everywhere on all the tools that we're actually building out. And so, yeah, so that is one part of it. And we're also exploring some interesting, you know, ideas around dynamic demand in the industry. So everybody knows that consulting firms know a certain level of information about the market. You know, they know, for example, how many satellites are being built, or, you know, what is the projection like for satellites, or so on. But nobody in the world knows at the micro or the granular level that we can say what is the demand for a certain component or a certain technology or a certain type of service, because we're the only one in the world who has any kind of demand data today. Right. So now the question is, like, we don't want to obviously compromise buyer information that this buyer is looking for this, or we don't want to also compromise supplier information saying this supplier is doing better than the other supplier, because we lose trust on both the sides if we do that. Right. So, but then the interesting question there is, what can we actually productize from all of that dynamic demand data that we have today that allows value creation in the industry without compromising buyers or suppliers at the same time?
Fair. What have you found?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that is ongoing at this point of time, and we do know that there are use cases. So, for example, you know, if they can say, for example, the market is moving in this direction. So, for example, if we can say, we see, you know, X number of missions or X number of demand cases where somebody is looking to procure integrated ADCS systems versus, you know, X number of buyers are looking to procure individual ADCS components and are willing to integrate all of them together, right? So that in itself is a signal to the market about what is the maturity like of the industry, because we've not really revealed any data of the buyers. We've also not revealed any data on the suppliers, but we are really telling the industry, this is the direction that we see industry is moving in that analysis.
That's interesting. Okay, so the move has been established, but no next steps are, well, the next steps are sort of continuous in this case, I guess. Okay, you know, so here's a question. I mean, from where you're standing right now, having a look at the market as a data sort of centric perspective, how do you make your business defensible in terms of gaining competitive advantage? You know, is there anything that makes defensibility a unique challenge for you guys, or it's a non-issue for space-focused marketplaces?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a question that we also ponder upon quite a lot as such, because we know the journey that we have gone through as well. And we know that we could have gone wrong in thousands of places in this journey. And anybody who wants to build what we are building, obviously, you know, a company like Amazon, if it sees enough value in the kind of stuff that we are doing, maybe can obliterate us in like a week with all their, you know, power in terms of monetary power and the capabilities that they have as such. But then it's also about trust in both buyers and suppliers that gives us defensibility at the same time. Because, you know, like there's a cultural change in suppliers as well in terms of how they look at all of this, the adoption. And it's extremely difficult for any new operator to come in and say, you know, you don't need to spend like SatSearch money on SatSearch anymore. You need to spend it on us. And for us to lose that customer, that's the one layer of defensibility, right? Because we already deliver enough value to our existing customers that gives us a level of defensibility. And the case for us losing that business becomes once we see somebody who, you know, is able to deliver more value than we do, and so on. So that is one level of it, right? But it's also about the buyer side. You know, the trust that we have with buyers is also kind of critical. But at the end of the day, you know, any nascent or marketplace or any marketplace for that matter, right, any given point of time, it only, I think, comes down to this in a B2B kind of a segment. It's purely about like trust on the buyer side and on the supplier side. And I guess, you know, if the market is big enough, there may be even like two or three or four or five different marketplaces for all of this, right, competing against us. It could be that there's enough meat on the bone kind of for four or five or other marketplaces to exist alongside us. And I think it's also a bad sign if we don't have competition, because it may be that we are doing something very stupid that we're doing, that there's no competition at all. At the same time, so that may also be a wrong sign that we're building out something tremendously stupid that we don't have any competition at all. So I think, competition is encouraging because it means that people are thinking in that direction. But at the end of the day, you know, we are a strong believer in relationships. As long as, you know, there may be like automation in transactions, you know, people may file requests and people may like, you know, use our platform and its features and so on. But at the end of the day, everything boils down to human relationships, no matter what technology platform it is. And for us, you know, we believe in like investing our resources in those human relationships with our suppliers and buyers at the same time. And for us, you know, this is our core principle of account management, because for us, you know, we go as long as it takes with any of our customers to make sure that they are happy as such. And in fact, you know, the only kind of churn that we've had is churn where suppliers who are, you know, who don't have product market fit. So we've had no churn among customers who have had to come into our platform and said, we don't like the value that we've got so far.
Fair. That makes sense. After 5 years of founding SatSearch, what are the biggest takeaways and most striking learnings that you've had from starting a marketplace in the space sector?
I would say, you know, the it's like any other phase of any other company, right? Because we, the biggest thing that we've learned is actually learning from other industries as to what we can bring from, you know, B2B marketplaces in the aerospace industry or the automotive industry or, you know, the electronics industry. I strongly believe that almost any, apart from the technology itself that we in the space industry are building, most other technology-driven industries are like at least two decades ahead of us in the space industry. And unfortunately, like most of us in the sales, in the space industry are in our own bubble of people, of, you know, people who are constrained to this space and satellite and all of this launch industry, who don't talk enough to people outside of our industries to learn from them as to what are the mistakes that they've done or how they've solved a particular problem. Or it may not be related to technology. It may purely be related to like how they've approached that problem, in case, you know, it fits. In our case, that's the inspiration that we've got. So, you know, one of our advisors and investors, angels that we have in our company, has built a marketplace for electronics components. And, you know, the they built it up ground up, and they sold the company. And you know, we're really lucky to have him as one of our backers in that sense. And then, you know, saying for us, you know, it's more than just that relationship that brings to the table. It's of having to go through that life cycle of building a B2B marketplace in a different industry, and having to go through the entire life cycle of building everything up and seeing everything through, and then eventually exiting out of it. And so every time we face a problem in the marketplace and the mechanics of it, and if there's any kind of transaction problems, we don't look at anything in the space industry at all. We just go to other industries, look at, okay, there was this problem in that industry. How did these guys solve this? And is there a model that we can kind of bring into the in our industry and apply it in certain ways, right? So, yeah, so that's been like the core of learnings for us. And then, you know, there are, of course, something unique to us in our space industry in terms of how we can control for behavior, because behavioral changes are cultural and it takes quite a long time to change. So we would love to see every supplier, you know, broadcast their prices, their you know, CAD models or any other information that they want openly, so that it's fully transparent for people looking at all of this. But again, you know, it's a very cultural change, and people are afraid that that competitors will take that information and do and use it against them and so on. But you know, that's also something that we advocate for, where we're trying to not just be like, you know, vendors or partners or so on, but we really want to be like consultants to any and every of these suppliers that we work with in moving forward the industry towards this, you know, globalization and openness of data and, you know, the supply chains, right? So, and that is, we're already seeing that, because some of these suppliers have already opened up that information that we work with. But then I think for us, the more we do it, the more the industry benefits overall. So that's, you know, been our kind of, I mean, there are always these small everyday problems that we see all the time. But I think overall, I do want to say that we can take a lot of inspiration from other sectors.
Just want to clarify something. Do you guys have external capital sources?
We have friends. We have the FFF, Friends, Family and Fools.
Friends, Family and Fools.
with us, who are very good friends of us, essentially. And it happened to, I mean, it's just that a couple of them are friends who are also happen to be CEOs of companies who built marketplaces in other sectors and successfully exited out of them, and have enough cash to say, I don't mind losing this money on that search. So
you gotta love those people.
Looking into that.
Now, one of the things here is that you personally have been working a lot with the Indian space community. So tell us a little bit about your role and what are some of the upcoming goals of the Indian space program from ISRO. I know they're focusing a little bit on human space flight. Priorities are changing from moon to, you know, lower Earth orbit again. So what are we looking at here?
Yeah, India is one of the exciting geographies, as I said, because of the large amount of problems and the large geography and the amount of people that we have, right? So it's one of the most untapped markets when it comes to these kinds of applications. And I think, you know, there are two communities in India today that are existing. One is the legacy space sector, which is, you know, the government driving everything through the space agency and its network of suppliers who are supplying to the space program, very much like Europe or NASA or whatever, and so on. But then there's also this exciting new space segment where people are trying to build their own satellites and trying to craft their own solutions and are able to do it, right? So we have about 50 startups that have come up in the last 7-8 years who are doing very interesting things across different parts of the value chain. And there's a lot of problems that have been systematically, you know, up and coming and have been solved over the last few years. When I started my first company in India in 2012, we didn't even have like a proper angel who was even willing to consider investing a dollar in like the space industry, right? So that's one of the major things that have been solved today, because we've had like so many technology millionaires and billionaires that have come up in India in the last 10 years that people are excited about technology and investing in technology. And there's tons of VC funds today in India, tons of angel investors who have come from the technology background and have sold their companies in other areas of technology and are funding them. So in the last 2 or 3 years, the capital availability for a lot of these companies to start, it has become quite low. There's tons of capital if they have good ideas today. The thing that is still not changed is the regulatory environment. We still don't have, proper rules and guidelines that allow companies to do like upstream activity. For example, if you want to launch rockets or you want to build satellites or so on, the full regulatory environment as to what happens when it comes to licensing spectrum for you to operate your spacecraft or, selling spacecraft to other countries or, launching your own rockets out of Indian soil. Those are things that are very uncertain still. I mean, there's some progress because we have a draft space bill and, they've created a sort of a regulator recently to solve these problems. It's an ongoing problem. But I still think it's still early days and we'll have to see how this transpires. And I'm hoping that some of these companies will succeed. But what is interesting for me is that once one of these companies in India solves for India, they get a massive scale to operate in because the problems may be very similar in Southeast Asia and in Africa. So, and the price points that they are able to solve may also be transferable to other Southeast Asian and African markets. So it gives them the scale to operate at a level that it may not give European or American companies to do it. But at least the thesis that I have internally for myself as such. And so that's something that I'm really excited about. We've already seen a few companies like, Numerate or Satshore or others who are operating in, countries like Philippines or Sri Lanka or Africa or so on. We've already seen that evidence with some of these companies. It's just a matter of time that we also see it not just in downstream, but also in the upstream of the industry, where if there's a couple of operators today who are building these launch vehicles who are successful, they may offer it at price points that are extremely reasonable against the international market. And as they develop reliability, they may be good. So it's an up-and-coming ecosystem, but unfortunately, due to the size and the scale of the country, India is like an elephant that takes a little bit of a time to move directions. That you can't compare with to smaller, countries that are of the size of the rabbits and they can move very fast, so on.
Fast and quick pace. So it makes sense. It makes sense, though. I mean, with the amount of population and the amount of issues that come with it. So I really want to appreciate because what you have done here, because I think it's phenomenal that you're including and sort of thinking about the Indian space community in the same perspective because of your time there. So understanding the limitations of trade secrets, what do you think that no one else understands? What's your deep inside, your unfair advantage of information?
It's a very hard question to say. I would say then, it's a question of relationships, I would say. For me, are really at least my kind of trade secrets at the end. Because at the end of the day, I think one of the things that we are seeing in any part of the world, be it my work in India or here in Europe or with SatSearch or whatever it is, to have cultural change happen, you need to have people who trust in your ideas. And that comes out of, building relationships that are not short-term, are not based on, profit that is just for the moment or that sale or so on, but are really in terms of empowering every person that we meet to be a part of the change for like the better in future, right? So be it a policymaker in India, or a bureaucrat, or any startup investor, or any of these suppliers that we work in our company, for example. At the end of the day, I think at any given point of time, I'm only thinking about what can we do to build strong relationships that allow people to like reflect on ideas that you can also work with them on, and then empower them to also look at your perspective. And if it is reasonable enough for them to then say, I acknowledge this and I want to be able to move in that direction as well, right? So I think this is what we see in India as well, because at the end of the day, you know, I'm one of the only, like, let's say, open critics of many things in India, because unlike, you know, many parts of the world, we in India are really not built out of criticizing work openly, right? So I've written like 75 papers, I've recorded over 50 podcast episodes and in criticizing the system and so on. So in that case, we're not really coming from a culture that criticizes openly, right? So, but then, you know, with all of that work, having done all of that work, I used to either get people telling me, okay, you know, you're just criticizing for the sake of criticizing. But I also had a number of people who came to me saying that you're speaking the truth and it is allowing to reflect on what we can do to change the status quo or so on. So, and I want to be able to work with that kind of people, right? Who say, I acknowledge what you are saying and I want to work with you to make sure that we want to build the future that is better than what we have today, right? So, and that's where I think, you know, I want to invest in any kind of personal, getting to know people to what they are and then looking at what can we do together is something that I always look at with anybody kind of I meet.
So here's the last question for you. And I wrap it up with all of our guests with that question. Why space and why space now?
I think we are one of the most underutilized tools by mankind. And at the end of the day, if you see the transformation that the aviation world underwent after the World War II, where, you know, people who were flying planes to just bomb each other started to fly, you know, between those countries and created airports and created all this with employment and created the whole industry of people moving between places. You can see the transformation of people, right, in that industry. And many people may not know, for example, that the early pioneers of rocketry, for example, in modern rockets, believed that rockets, the application of rockets was for male. Like they were looking at post and looking at how can we take, you know, posts from New York and send it to California through a rocket, because it's going to save us a lot of time while, you know, taking the road takes a lot of time in the US between New York and California. So, you know, that was the history of very early stage, you know, model rockets in the 1920s and 1910s. And, you know, many people may not even know that history as of today, as we stand, that people would have thought that the first applications for rockets that people thought was post or, you know, or what the people called as rocket mail, for example, right? And today we still stand in that precipice where we're still very underutilized by the society. And only now, I think, as we link applications in agriculture, in energy, and any other sector, and we're becoming the backbone of any other technology infrastructure and problems in the society, will we realize that we're solving a lot of the problems. So if SpaceX is going to be able to take people from, you know, US to Australia in like 90 minutes instead of like 36 hours, I'm happy, you know, if they're able to prove that price point and are able to, like, you know, take the all of, I mean, that's real productivity, right, for people to get there and safely and at a price point that they can afford and everything else. And so I think we still remain an undiscovered tool in the quiver of, you know, humanity's, you know, arrows that humanities can shoot. And so hopefully our generation is the one that realizes the potential, and then hopefully, you know, then we'll have a community that is as big as the aviation industry or as big as you know, the automotive industry or whatever it is that has established over the last 100 years, that is, you know, that kicks off from our generation.
Well, Narayan, it's been a fantastic conversation, very insightful. I think the viewers and the listeners are going to have a fantastic time listening. You know, not only that you've given us insights into the backgrounds on SatSearch, but there are some key nooks there that I don't think I myself or the producers here knew either. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time, and glad to have you with us, and we'd love to have you back again in the future for other purposes.
Again, you know, thank you very much for having me as a guest, and you know, giving me the opportunity to share some of my insights. I mean, people can always reach out to me at narayan@satsearch.com if they have anything that they want to discuss, or they also want to debate on some of my views that I said as well. So thank you again for the opportunity.
Well, thanks for joining us for another episode of Space Forward. Stay tuned for more deep dives, explorations, and journeys we have in store for you. Follow us on Spotify, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or YouTube. Hear you next time. Send us your comments and questions. We will feature them in one of our next episodes.